Hello, everybody. This is Jeremy Swenson. I'm the CEO of Abstract Forward Consulting. We are a firm that focuses on cybersecurity, process improvement, and change management consulting. This is our podcast, and in the studio today, we have James Redman, an experienced third-party risk management and assessment auditor, and also someone who has the personal certification in the high trust category. We're going to talk today about those topics, and I'd like James just to go ahead and give an introduction on his background.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for letting me on your podcast. Yeah, so I have a background in the IT security, IT audit, and then especially on the third-party risk management. And so I've worked at United Health Group for 3 years of just building out their program, application security, cloud security, and then we base a lot of that stuff on the HITRUST framework.
I don't think everybody in the audience even knows about the HITRUST framework. So just take a few minutes, explain to us what is HITRUST, how did you get acquainted and certified in it, what is that process like?
HITRUST really, it's been around for about 10 years, but it really took off in about 2014, 2015. Pretty much United Health Group was the first company that was really on board with requiring that requirement, not only for United Health Group, but for all their vendors. So we're looking at United Health Group is Fortune 6, the leading healthcare provider in pretty much the world. And their vendor population is significant. And so when they required all their vendors to be HITRUST certified within 18 months, it really put HITRUST on the map. And HITRUST is really dedicated to providing security requirements for healthcare. Previously to HITRUST, a lot of people relied on HIPAA or HITECH, which had some general guidance, but didn't really have the prescriptive controls that was required. And so, you know, doing these vendor assessments for United Health Group, we really saw security all over the map. We saw some companies that had phenomenal security, but a lot of companies didn't. And from what I've seen is most companies do not do security unless they're required to by their clients. It seems like about 10% of clients really do take security seriously. And you know, when we come on site, you know, they're really strong controls, but majority of them don't. And so a lot of the CEOs of these major healthcare providers realize that we need a stronger security framework that was dedicated to healthcare. And so HIPAA was the one that was chosen. It's a very prescriptive, scalable framework, depending on how much PHI you have, how many records, what is your size, geographic locations. It can dictate what levels of HITRUST are required from you. There's levels 1, 2, and 3. And also, you know, if you're doing PCI, if you're state of Massachusetts, Texas, so there's different regulatory at the state level. So HITRUST is really the framework that it's dedicated to healthcare at this time. I know in the future that they are trying to go more industry agnostic, but right now it's dedicated to healthcare.
And can you talk about some of the controls that come as a part of the HITRUST assessment? Give me maybe a couple of examples of controls that you've seen with and why they're good.
So it just really HITRUST, the controls in HITRUST really are not necessarily unique. They take controls from NIST, from PCI. You can look at their literature. They encompass a lot of controls from these various frameworks, put them together. So like your standard like access controls, policy and procedures, but it just really, the difference with HITRUST is very prescriptive. So I know like other frameworks like SOC 2 is, you know, what controls do you use to meet this criteria? HITRUST is, you know, do this in a prescriptive way, and the wording kind of has to match the controls. And so it's very prescriptive. A lot of times you have to go on the HITRUST site and pull up their individual controls. So it can be anywhere from 150 to you know, up to 1400. It kind of really dictates on the size of the framework, but it's a general comprehensive framework.
So if I'm a healthcare IT executive, I can look at the HITRUST controls and make sure my organization is complying with those. And ideally, if we do that, you know, we're going to at least be secure at the bare bone level, though conforming to a framework never guarantees security. I'm looking here at the certification criteria for HITRUST version 8.1 on my computer. A couple of the areas that I see covered, privilege management being one, network connection control being another, service delivery, segregation of duties, change management, backup, network controls, teleworking roles and responsibilities, disposal of media, electronic messaging, information security awareness, education and training, which I would say that last one is probably the most important one. So with that in mind, information security awareness, education and training, I'd like to move to a different topic, which is generally about, you know, your background in vendor risk management assessment. I know you spent a lot of time with that at UHG, but even you spent some time at a couple of respected accounting firms doing that same type of work. So talk to us about third-party risk management. What are some of the typical pitfalls that you've seen, and maybe a couple of examples of where organizations have really done well with it?
Vendor management, it's very complicated. It takes a lot of the pitfalls. I'm just kind of go through a lot of things I've seen that don't work. What a lot of companies do is just send out a questionnaire to their vendors and say, fill this out. So you send out 150 to 300 questionnaire. Your clients, you know, fill them out, get back to you. But what does that really mean? You can say, you know, do you have a policy? Yes, no. Do you have two-factor authentication? Yes, no. So you can get a lot of results and say, no, we don't have two-factor authentication. So boom, that would trigger a finding. Then what are you going to do about it? Are you going to follow up with it? Or are you just going to assign a risk score to the vendor? So it's kind of, so you get a questionnaire, but you can get these answers. You may or may not know if they're accurate. And then what are you going to do with that? So there's a lot of pitfalls. So for one instance, it's, you assign a risk score to a vendor. So you have, let's just pick on Target. Vendor Target is at 87 score. What does that really mean? A lot of the time, these security questionnaires, you really need to bring the business into it. You need to understand what is that relationship. So if Target has your PHI data, maybe it's not even at Target. Maybe it's in Amazon. It's in a cloud. So a lot of the findings related to Target corporate, really, I mean, they do apply, but they really are not that important if everything is locked into the cloud and only one or two people at Target have access to that cloud environment. And so you got to be able to take that. You got to understand relationship, tailor the questions to the relationship, and then figure out where is the true risk items.
So, James, I want to just interject here. I have some knowledge about these type of assessments. And I think the problem that you're getting at is that the questions out of the box don't fully understand the context in which they're asked. So a good auditor or assessor, if you will, really needs to do a good job upfront understanding the business context. Some questions on these vendor risk management assessments may be relevant, some may not. It depends upon the type of business that you're dealing with. And as we all know, most of the major breaches, network intrusion, penetration, if not all of them, none of them have happened because the organizations failed to go through one of these assessments. They've all done that. They've got the paperwork to prove that they've done the assessments, that everything was checked off. And the people that come in typically, I'm going to sort of rip on accounting firms for a minute here, but those people, they come in with no experience at that business. They're good at knowing, you know, the principles generally of IT audit, third-party risk management assessment, but what they don't know is that organization. And the people who know it are the people who have been there for years and helped build the products, write the processes and policies, and they know about all the hidden details that make a huge difference in accurately assessing risk. If we take a look at the Target data breach, that was a vendor risk management related incident where it was an HVAC vendor who had access to do maintenance to the HVAC systems at the retail stores. They had done all the assessments. What the assessments didn't accurately catch was how close that vendor would be in having internet access to the actual point of sale server connection points. And there's an example where something was missed. A more thorough vendor risk assessment would have caught something like that. But those are just a few of my thoughts hearing you talk, but continue on with, you know, your stories about how do vendors get it right? What can companies do to be really on the cusp of innovation with vendor risk management assessment?
Yeah, so obviously with Target, the information that we've heard publicly is probably not fully what happened privately, but you know, based on you know what's public is right. So you have a vendor, and you can do the vendor assessment, but a lot of times the question that might have been missed there is they didn't talk internally to figure out the people actually managing the HVAC relationship within Target. Did you actually understand what they really do and what kind of level of access do they have within Target? And so that's one thing I see a pitfall where people don't actually really understand the whole relationship internally. And again, you got to look at vendor management. Sometimes you only have so much budget and time. So you kind of have to draw a line to how deep you can go. So scoping their relationship is like with Target. Is what do they actually do for us? What kind of level of access do they have? And sometimes a lot of companies don't even have the information. They might have a list of vendors. They might have some vagueness of what they do for us. So when I do the assessments, the first step is, what do they do for us internally? Try to have that conversation with that business representative. Tell them what you're doing. And then also try to get them behind you, to back you when you do this assessment. Because if you do an assessment and something comes up out of it, your business is really your final audience. As a security professional, yeah, we can raise our hand and say, this is insecure, drop the business and run. But, you know, business needs to succeed. And we need to, you know, help the business build security relationships. So when you get to that, you got to talk to the internal representative, tell them what the problem is, and look at solutions. Can you, you know, minimize that protected data that they have access to? Can you set up, let's just say with the HVAC, can you set up a Citrix environment where, yeah, they can access your environment to do their work, but you have a Citrix or a virtualized environment where it's all kind of stayed within a sandbox. So even if that vendor is compromised, their amount of access to within Target is very limited. So they might be able to get into some of these systems to see it, but they won't be able to extract that data back out. And so there's a lot of tangents to this vendor management system that needs to be looked at. And so it's not always you can do this in day one, but just kind of get the ball rolling and figure out how to build an effective risk management program, especially with internal involvement.
And I just want to remind our audience that you are certified in a few different things, James. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about your certifications and how you use those applicable to vendor risk management assessment?
Right. So I started out, you know, in finance, real accounting. I was trying to do a combination of accounting and IT. So I had the CPA, which is now inactive. But I've always done the IT audit, IT security realm. I've never actually done the finance side, but I have a good background in what is the finance processes. And so I got the CPA, the CISP, Certified Information Security Professional, Certified Information System Auditor, also certified in high trust on a personal level. So all these certifications really help come together in the vendor risk management process, because you kind of need to understand the financial side of a business. And obviously high trust is good for healthcare. And also understand the security. So it's kind of I'm kind of more of a unicorn in that space where I can understand the business and the security side, and I can talk to the finance, I can talk to CPAs, I can talk the security realm. So it's all those kind of really come together for, you know, vendor risk management.
Wow, what a great background. We're so lucky to be talking to you, James. Thanks for being here. I want you to talk about a situation where you were doing a vendor risk management assessment and the company just had to be cut. There was just too much risk there. And you just couldn't work with the company. That's a hard cut to make, but companies have to make that cut. How does a company make that decision, especially if they're on the fence? Maybe it may be a company that has a really good product, a good software, or they do really good work. They don't want to have to not do business with the company, but they can't because the risk is too high or there's too much ambiguity. So again, first part of the question, situation, you saw a vendor, you guys had to cut. And then the second part of the question, how do you deal with that ambiguity?
There's a situation where a smaller healthcare clinic. I initially set up a Citrix session with her, and she was unable to access the Citrix session. And so I asked her what computer she's using. She said she's using Windows XP. And so initially that kind of threw up a red flag, and then I started realizing like how much information are we sending to them? You know, what can we do? So, I mean, after that initial meeting, I went to the business representative and just says, you know, here's what we're looking at. Being that they have Windows XP, that's a huge red flag to me. I don't really suspect they have a lot of security controls. Do you want to continue with this assessment? So right away, before you waste everyone's time, just talk to them, see what they say. A lot of times they'll say, yes, you know, go ahead with the assessment because we need at least document internally why we need to cut this vendor. So there, you're going to see a lot of consolidation in the vendor management space. And a lot of it's, it's just kind of the point is these smaller companies cannot have all these security controls in place, especially if you're a bigger company that has strong security control posture that you need to be in place. So you're going to see consolidation there. The second part is, what happens if you have a vendor that's key, that has a lot of security risk, but you need them, they do a critical niche role, or they have a critical role in the business where you cannot just terminate. So then you have, that's where it gets really, really interesting. I've seen, there's no clear answer to what to do here. I have seen situations where these bigger companies, there's kind of big companies that also need to help up with the smaller companies where it create processes where these smaller companies can do the work but not have the risk of the data. So you set up a sandbox for them to do the work. You can provide them laptops for them to do the work. They have to come on site and do the work versus in their office. Can you remove the protected data? If you're sending them data, can you remove the protected data so they only do the data that's worked? Can you de-anonymize it? Can you change the key identifiers into a random key chart where they can do the work? And if somebody else, a malicious actor gets it, it's not valuable. But when it comes back, you can match it up against his key, and then it'll pull into that critical data. So there's a lot of things, and that's where it really takes outside the box thinking to get these small companies to do the work without bringing a lot of data security risk to the company.
Wow, those are some great, great examples. Another thing that companies are dealing with in this context is the offshoring opportunity. So a lot of the IT functions being done out of India or Ireland, Philippines, Malaysia, etc. And with that, oftentimes comes a lower price tag and a cultural difference. But in your experience, how have you seen offshoring affect vendor risk management?
Yeah, so I actually have a lot of experience with this. So what the biggest problem that with offshoring this role is, you really need half of this role is business related, half is security. So anybody can take a security questionnaire, look at it and say, okay, these controls are missing, but can they follow up, have a conversation with your internal business representatives, which could be up to VPs in your company, as well as CEOs level at your client companies? Can they manage, maybe a pretty frank conversation on, how to get two-factor authentication in place? How can you protect that business relationship with two-factor? It's in a lot of these offshore people, they just don't have the U.S. cultural knowledge, the business acronym to run those high-level meetings and get the results that are needed. So a lot of times what you see is they're just kind of reverting to the control, just repeating to the client, we need a two-factor in place without really having the in-depth business conversations with the client and your business representatives.
There's a lot of talk now about the cloud, outsourcing to the cloud, running servers in the cloud, and it can be pretty cost effective, and it's a way for organizations to move that risk or that service to a third party. In your experience, James, what are some of the trade-offs that you've seen with the cloud?
Yeah, so if you're a small company, cloud is the only way you can even get the security controls in place. Bigger companies and mid-size, it's a little different story. But for assessing vendors in the cloud, that is a whole nother ballgame. You'll have your vendors say, we're in Amazon, we're secure. Amazon handles all of our security, and here's the Amazon SOC 2 report. But so as an assessor looking at a firm that has stuff in the cloud, you can't just say check the box in Amazon. How can you assess an Amazon environment that your vendor is in? A lot of times your right to audit is with the vendor, and you can't go to Amazon and say, I'm gonna do a pen test. I mean, there's a lot of legal ambiguity with a third party cloud. But a lot of times what you can do is you can look at vendors, what's a vendor doing to secure Amazon? So you can look at their admin portals. Do they have two-factor in place for them to access Amazon? And what service lines of Amazon are you using? So it's like, is encryption in place? So a lot of times they'll say, oh, yeah, Amazon covers encryption. They cover all that just as blank slate, and they're good to go. But you need to figure out, do they actually have these settings enabled with an Amazon? So it takes and each one of these playbooks are not audit playbooks. They're really tough to cover cloud. And especially with cloud, the security posture is always changing. And what Amazon and especially they like to roll all these new security features year after year, and there's not really much training going on to the people administering these clouds. Do they actually enable all the right settings?
Another thing that comes up with cloud outsourcing is the question of how much of it does an organization do. So if I'm a CIO or if I'm a chief information security officer, I'm probably not going to have everything be in the cloud. That's just probably too much. With the cloud, obviously the cloud provider handles some of that risk. Should an incident occur, that cloud provider, like an Amazon, is pretty fortified, pretty trained, and pretty resilient. There's been very few cases of Amazon or Google, even Microsoft, having been down for long periods of time because so many organizations are dependent upon their infrastructure offerings. But that CIO or that CISO, they should still have some stuff run in-house because they can control that and see that to a different degree than what they can see outside. So I think there's a mix. I don't know if it's 80-20% or if it's 70-30. It depends upon the company. But the point is you got to use the cloud to your advantage. And with vendor risk management and cloud, kind of reminds me of backups or resiliency, having multiple options for your infrastructure. So maybe your primary vendor for outsourced cloud infrastructure is Amazon, but do you have one on the back burner? Do you have one that's, you know, ready to go should Amazon have a major incident? Because let's face it, all these big cloud providers are at some point going to lose their leadership position. You know, Amazon could have a major incident. Google could. Let's hope they don't. But so have you seen with organizations that have a standby cloud provider ready, that they have a backup plan that they could roll over to a different provider in the event that something were to happen? And then what is the mix in your mind that good CIOs and CISOs have for percent at cloud and percent that's not in cloud?
Yeah. So I've never really seen companies really have a backup cloud. They really rely on Amazon's redundancy. They're really relying on Amazon to provide the backup for them. So if Amazon goes down, I think, you know, it's kind of like, I remember, a couple years ago, East Coast had an incident where there's a significant percentage of the U.S. lost on, you know, their internet to their site. So, I mean, that's a big single point of failure, almost more on a national infrastructure level.
Amazon does have failovers. I know a little bit about the Amazon infrastructure, and I know that if you are using them, they do have multiple data centers throughout the United States that if one goes down, they will roll over to another. But that doesn't mean that they're always going to maintain their leadership reputation in this space. I mean, they're good right now. Don't get me wrong. Very respected. But the point is, and this is probably applicable for the mid-sized to the bigger companies more than the smaller, especially companies that have a lot of data and are generating more and more data, like healthcare is a perfect example. I can't imagine the big healthcare players just relying on one cloud provider or even two.
Yeah, so kind of with Amazon, you see they like to Amazon their own cloud environment. So all their names, structures, everything is kind of the Amazon way. And that's why I'm starting to see more companies go to Azure, because it follows the same structure as their on-site data centers. And the same, you know, operating systems, the same type of wording structure. So if you had to, so let's say you want to move away from Amazon, you're going to have to totally rebuild your data center, you know, take everything out, translate it from Amazon back into Microsoft speak, you know, to build up your own on-site center. If it's in Azure, it's more easier to rebuild. Because it follows the same conventions, the same protocols, and the same structure. So that's kind of what I see there.
How are these cloud providers handling the logging? And is it actually helpful for the organization? Or are they better off doing their own logging?
None of the cloud providers do good logging. So you have to do on-site. You have to do it on-site. So the best companies have a SIEM on-site which is pulling all their logs from the cloud into their centralized SIEM. Because Amazon, Azure, they can take the logs, but they can't. You have to add on. So for logging, you have to add in a module within cloud. You can't rely on the native CloudWatch and Amazon or Azure to do the logging, based on your internal policies. So you have to build in the cloud. You kind of have to manually configure it, or you can take those logs and go on site. So you're saying like 80/20. So that's where one thing where a lot of secure companies will do their SIEM still on site. Also like intrusion detection. So obviously you get some native intrusion detection with Amazon Azure, which is like denial of service. They can do a lot of those basic defaults. But what happens if you're trying to do application layer detection of intrusions or some of that stuff that's customized to your environment? The default for these clouds is just default for everyone, universal rules. Amazon, they can't just manually configure each instance to your environment. And so there's a couple of things where you kind of need to add on additional controls beyond just the native security settings of these cloud providers.
What's it going to take for innovation in security in your mind, James, having been at the accounting firms you've been at, having been at the healthcare companies that you've been at, having the certifications you have, and now being independent like you are, what's it going to take for organizations to get to a state of security innovation, and how close are we?
Well, security is always behind the eight ball with any new systems, and with innovation, what I'm starting to see more innovation in security go on is 10 years ago it was all about perimeter security, and now we're starting to see detection, prevention, monitoring, controls. Well, what I'm starting to see more and more now is isolation of where the data is. So with cloud, so a lot of people, they'll isolate all their PHI into a cloud and pull it away from their corporate network because you have to assume that your perimeters will be breached. And so then once you go from the perimeter, can you get into where the gold and the Fort Knox? Can they transverse that environment? And so what I'm seeing now for innovation is security more where the data actually is, not just spending just tons of money all over the place, but focusing on where the risk is. And so like the firewall rules, you're starting to see, the good companies are really implementing strong controls around where the data is and loosening them as they get out. So on the perimeter, it's a lot lower rules. Traditionally, it's been strong, really strong on the perimeter. And as you get in, once you kind of get in, then you're kind of in, you can go anywhere. So that's where I guess I'm seeing the innovation going to now.
So there's been a lot of talk about data breaches in recent years. It's very costly. The average cost per compromised record is around $140 to $150, maybe $155, depending upon the industry. And in the healthcare space, it's upwards of $350, and in some reports as high as $380 per compromised record. That's from the Ponemon Institute. I think those numbers are a little bit inflated. But the point is that the cost of a data breach is very expensive. Another thing that's interesting about data breaches is that the average organization doesn't know about them until well after the fact. And the number one way of notification is from a third party, meaning an auditor or the authorities tell you, hey, your data has been breached. And so this may be 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 months, sometimes even a year after it happened. With Equifax, we're talking about 5.5 months after they were breached. They then found out that they were breached. Now, in their case, they were told what they needed to patch. They didn't patch it because they had bad prioritization of patch management. But I want to hear from you and your experience as, a third-party risk assessor, IT auditor, and overall security technologist. What have you seen around data loss prevention?
Right. So data loss prevention, a lot of times when people want to implement data loss prevention, they go buy a tool and put it in place. You're trying to look for the critical data elements. But, I always look at data loss prevention as a bigger picture, trying to look at where the data is and block the data from leaving wherever you store that data. And so a tool is obviously one scenario. A lot of times I've seen people where they just block everything. And so this company was a print and mail vendor, in which we talked to him about how to implement data loss prevention. And so we actually had a lot of back and forth conversations, several of them, probably in a couple hours worth of time, where going through and just implementing a data loss prevention solution. And what we kind of ended up coming up with is totally create an offline process to print the PHI. So there's no electronic connections to these environments. So literally, we're sending encrypted USB drive to this vendor, and they're running their offline system to print these records and print them out. So it's like, that's, to me, it's like the best data loss prevention strategy you can do is so that you can do a process, you can do a tool. There's many different ways you got to look at where the data is, like draw a big circle on a whiteboard, and then every exit where that data can leave, have a process to block or detect that data from leaving.
Well said. And again, data is your most valuable asset. For the organization that James and I are trying to serve, data is their gold. Data is everything. And that's what the threat actor wants. They want your data. They can commit lots of different frauds with the data. They can sell it on the black market. Your data needs to be hugely, hugely protected. Some industries are more data-centric than others, but data is continuing to be more and more relevant. And then the other thing about data is it really tells you everything you need to know. Every piece of data that you have at your organization, doesn't matter what your organization is, will tell you what you need to know. The question is, can you decipher it and can you do the math to get relevant, contextually aware answers? And that's the really hard part. And this kind of leads into the whole logging debate. And I know, James, you have some, you know, exposure and experience around logging and how organizations can do it effectively, but just a few statistics around log management. So the false positive rate that comes out of logs is somewhere around 50 to 60%. So most organizations in their SOCs and all the way up to the CISO, they're spending thousands, if not millions, chasing down false positives. And they literally have to do it because they don't know if that one false positive could be a part of a true positive. And if they don't chase it down, then you know, it could be something. And so they're overwhelmed. And if we look at the state of the tools, so I've written a couple of posts on tools and what their capabilities are, and this kind of gets at the broader question of state of machine learning, state of AI, et cetera. There's a lot of hype out there around security tools that are able to best use logs to somehow come up with machine learning to better protect your organization. And all of that is dependent upon good configuration for your organization. But I just want to stop here and just hear from you, James. What's been your experience with good log management?
So the one thing you got to realize is a lot of these hackers, they can see the same tools that you have. So they can see the same how your default logging is set up. So it's, you need to do logging, especially since as an IT audit background, that's required by a lot of compliance requirements. But you really want to look at where are the critical areas hackers want to get into. And just think of your car. You want to protect your car from getting broken into. And so anybody can go in. They can go to the city of a Chevy. They can go to the GM manual, pull up all the information, what wires to cut, where to put the key in, how to break in. But why don't we do something a little custom? Why don't you set up, you put a remote disconnect on the battery. So if you hit the button, it doesn't matter what you do in the ignition, you're not going to get the car started. So the same thing with log management of a company. Why don't you do something a little custom? Set up a honeypot. Set up some areas where you have a server that there should be no connection going to that server. You say you have a VM environment. You can stand up a VM, put it in your environment. If anybody pings that box, boom, you should get a security alert. And then that'll, a lot of those will be a lot more, instead of being false positives, you know there's something phishing going on because there's some process in your environment doing something that they shouldn't be. So set up like kind of those little landmines that they can trigger and detect a malicious incident within your company. You know, the challenge you have is a lot of these you have to do just because of IT audit requirements, but just do that little extra. A lot of these are not that hard to set up. You know, if you have 100 VMs, what's the cost of setting up one more? So there's different strategies. Just thinking outside the box, find something custom that a hacker would probably trip going into it. Something outside of the baseline manual that they're not aware of.
So the honeypots and the honey nets, hugely, hugely valuable. More organizations need to be doing that, and I think you're going to see a lot more of that. Some of the things you've just been talking about were kind of getting that creativity to add one more VM when you already have 100. It really isn't a big cost. I get that. But sometimes security is lacking in these organizations, and it's because they don't think creatively. It's because they're forced to think the way that they've always thunk, and they're biased by accounting firms. And it's not to say that they don't do some good work. They do. But let's face it, this is a broken industry. More breaches are going to happen. More network penetration is going to happen. Companies are literally going to go out of business because of this. People are going to lose their job. One last question, and that is, how do we bake creativity into
security?
Right. So, that's a great question, because everyone has a limited budget, limited resources. So you're going to focus your resources on, where the risk is. So it just kind of back, can you isolate that data? Instead of trying to secure, let's go back to the VMs, 100 VMs, what happens if only 4 of them have the data? Can you isolate that in a separate cloud environment? Can you isolate it on a separate subnet and then put your security controls in place there? So you can dedicate your resources, isolate the data, and actually might save a lot of money. And then also, when you keep like a standalone cloud and that's where all the data is, you can probably reduce a lot of your IT compliance requirements, because they're not going to have to look at 100 firewalls. They only need to look at 2.
One thing that comes to mind hearing you is simplicity and duplicate of data. So my background is, some of my listeners may know, I spent a number of time consulting at some health insurance companies, and I did a lot with infrastructure decommission and a lot of deletion and identification of duplicate data. So a lot of organizations have this duplicate of data. So you're talking about the VMs, which of the 4 are the most critical. That's just it. You got to know and be able to map what really matters, because not everything does. And if something doesn't matter, or something is needlessly duplicative, get rid of it, delete it. That's one way to reduce the attack surface. And I know for big organizations, that's hard because they have so much. But technology is changing, and it allows you to get more out of one tool. And it's a good way to do it, is just simplify. Because if you don't, then your executives have the problem of fog. There's so much complexity that they can't see straight through all of it to make good decisions. So, I fear for that IT executive who is getting executive summary reports with conflicting information and ambiguous presentations, and they're looking at that going, how do I make a decision out of this? And that's a lot of them. They don't know. And then, you would want to hire a firm like ours to come in, help you make some sense of that, dig a little bit deeper and see what really is going on there and how can we make things better. That's what we do here at Abstract Forward Consulting, is we disrupt to make things better. And that's a hard pill to swallow, but it needs to happen, because the traditional firms haven't been able to provide that. So with that, we're going to close out our podcast today. Again, today's topic was around third-party risk management and related concepts. Our guest today was James Redmond, multi-certified and experienced security practitioner. So thanks again, everybody, for being here. And we hope to catch you sometime soon.